everyone. Welcome to Midcast. I'm your host, Manar Adley. Now, Joe Biden may have won the presidential election, but his victory masks a deeper rot within the American political system, one where both parties have become the servants of increasingly powerful corporations of Wall Street and of the military-industrial complex, but especially the Democratic Party, which presents itself to the public as a symbol of social justice, peace and justice. In fact, our guest today, Chris Hedges, has for years argued that the Democratic Party long ago sold its soul and turned its back on the American people, and that we have lived through what he calls a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. Chris is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Balkans, and the Middle East, where he saw the bloody realities of U.S. empire firsthand. He hosts a show now on RT called On Contact. He's also the author of over a dozen books, the latest of which is America, The Farewell Tour, about the potentially terminal decline of the United States. Welcome to Mintcast, Chris.
Thank you.
In your latest article for SheerPost titled The Collective Suicide of the Liberal Class, you describe liberals in many ways, but one that I think is most relatable to most Americans is when you say liberals largely comprised of the professional managerial class that dutifully recycles and shops for organic produce and is concentrated on the two coasts have profited from the ravages of neoliberalism. Who are the liberal class that you've described, and how do we divorce ourselves from this specific character?
They're the technocrats, the managers, the corporate lawyers, the bankers, the financiers, the people who run social media, digital media platforms, they have done quite well through this process of deindustrialization and the offshoring of jobs and austerity programs. And so they have this kind of patina of morality where they are anti-racist and they are against misogyny, and they support LGBTQ rights, and they don't like Islamophobia. But this is just window dressing, I think, to make the brutality of the particular economic system and the social inequality palatable, one. And two, I think, to posit themselves as kind of moral individuals. But in fact, the policies that they have embraced by embracing the Democratic Party have made war on all of those people they claim to have some kind of sympathy for. In particular, people of color have suffered tremendously under neoliberalism. When Clinton destroyed the welfare program, Democratic administration, 70% of the original recipients were children, the explosion of mass incarceration, again, a Clinton-Biden project that ended up more than doubling our prison population, the militarization of police, the passing of all sorts of draconian sentencing laws, in particular drug laws that tripled and quadrupled sentences. All of this came out of a Democratic Party. And I've long argued I was a supporter of Ralph Nader.
Right.
Indeed, Ralph's speechwriter. And I think Ralph understood, nobody knows corporate power better in America than Ralph Nader. And he watched that legitimate liberal wing of the Democratic Party eviscerated and destroyed. So you had this kind of faux liberal as represented by Clinton or an Obama, realized that the only mechanism left was to create an exodus from the party, 5, 10, 15 million people that walked out. This was the only hope of pressuring the Democratic Party to adopt some liberal or perhaps progressive programs. Unfortunately, the two-party system worked to crush Nader's candidacy, of course, locked him out of the debate stage, challenged his voting lists, and the corporate media amplified these charges, ridiculous charges, for instance, that Nader lost, the elect was responsible for Bush winning in 2000, this kind of stuff. So it didn't work. And now we have this, we have a country where 74 million people support a demagogue, 70% of whom, that's 51 million people, believe that the election was stolen. And I've long written and believed that Trump is a symptom. He's not the disease. He's what distressed or decayed societies vomit up. And I watched that in Yugoslavia. Same kind of economic breakdown and paralysis by a ruling elite that created these repugnant figures like Slobodan Milosevic or Franjo Tuđman or Radovan Karadžić.
And we'll get to Yugoslavia in later in the interview, but I'm curious to know your thoughts on Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and them hijacking this kind of image of social justice. I mean, you talked about Bill Clinton and Obama. What about Joe Biden and Kamala Harris? What can we expect from them?
Well, we know exactly what we can expect from them because they both have long track records. Biden was chosen by Obama as his running mate because, in essence, he voted as a Republican. So, you know, what are we going to get from a Biden administration? We will get support for the apartheid state, uncritical and unconditional support for the apartheid state of Israel. We will see the continuation of wholesale government surveillance of the American public. We will see these trade deals like NAFTA and the continued offshoring of jobs to underpaid workers in sweatshops in Mexico, China, Vietnam. We will see the continuation of the world's largest prison population, 2.3 million people. Although we're 4% of the world's population, we will continue to see militarized police terrorize and gun down with impunity poor people in our inner cities. We won't get a Green New Deal. We won't get immigration reform. You will see support for fracking. You will see a continuation of, in essence, a segregated public school system where wealthy communities and neighborhoods have adequate public schools and poor communities do not. In fact, are often burdened with for-profit militarized charter schools. You'll see the continued deregulation of the banking industry and the financial sector. You'll see the price gouging of the for-profit insurance and pharmaceutical corporations, and the denial of universal health care. And I want to be clear that the failure to contain the pandemic is not solely due to Trump's ineptitude. It's due to the closure or consolidation of hospitals across the country, the reduction of hospital beds to less than a million, the fact that you have millions of Americans who can only get health insurance through their employers. And of course, many of them, I think 40 some million, have lost their jobs. You will not see a change in terms of the ability of dark money, corporate money, oligarchic money to buy our elections. That's what we're gonna get. And we see that with the appointments. And that has long been, that's why Biden was anointed, and he was anointed by the Democratic Party hierarchy for the nomination, and why they once again thwarted Bernie Sanders' campaign. You remember, if they didn't have this kind of corporate money, huge infusions of corporate money, and Biden got more of it than Trump, just as Obama got more corporate money than McCain did, these figures wouldn't exist. Pelosi, Schumer, like Mitch McConnell, their power comes from being a conduit of that money to anointed candidates. And when Biden was the senator from Delaware, which is where a lot of credit card companies are headquarters, he was derisively in the Senate called Senator Credit Card. He abjectly served the interests of credit card companies like MBNA, which is the largest independent credit card company in the country, which, by the way, also employed his son, Hunter. That's what we're getting.
So basically, we're getting more of the same instead of the change and hope that that many progressives have thought that they would get under another Democrat. And, you know, you talked a little bit about Yugoslavia and your experience there covering the economic crisis and what that did to society there. Talk to me about how that's taking place right here in America.
I think you have to look at how the country has been essentially bifurcated into warring demographics. Now, a lot of that is due to the media.
Right.
Because the media landscape, and Matt Taibbi wrote a good book on this called Hate Inc. And on one side of the cover is Sean Hannity and the other side is Rachel Maddow, because they do the same thing, as Taibbi points out. So under the old system, you had a kind of domination by three major networks and a few major newspapers, like my old employer, the New York Times. All of that was shattered with the internet. And people went after particular demographics and catered exclusively to those demographics. That's what Fox News does, but it's what MSNBC does. I think 94% of the people who watch NBC identify as supporters of the Democratic Party. But then publications like the New York Times have also fallen into this partisanship. So the Pew Research Center did a poll last summer and found that 91% of the readers of the New York Times identify as Democratic Party supporters, 87% of the listeners to NPR. And so by catering to that demographic, in the same way the right-wing media caters to their demographic, you create two parallel narratives. Both narratives, I think, are fictitious. On the right wing is demonizing Muslims and immigrants and liberals and in this latest iteration with Giuliani, you know, Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, who's been dead since 2013. But the Democratic Party does the same. So they, instead of being self-critical or self-analytical and grasping the great damage that they had done and their complicity in doing that damage to the working class, they slogged for 2 years this idea that Putin and Russia was responsible for the election of Trump, which isn't to say that Russia didn't interfere in the elections. I don't have proof one way or another, but I would not be surprised if it did, like China. I was overseas for 20 years, the United States in 6 of those years in Latin America. There wasn't an election in Latin America we didn't interfere in. The same was true in all of the other countries I covered. In 1996, when Boris Yeltsin ran for re-election in Russia, the Clinton administration orchestrated a $10 billion IMF loan, of which an estimated $1.5 billion of that went directly into Yeltsin's campaign because, well, Yeltsin served American business interests, and that was a correct assessment. So I'm not saying that there was an outside interference, but the idea that Trump is a product of the Kremlin is really a form of demagoguery, which is no different from what we've seen Giuliani do in the wake of this election. So in essence, the Trump operatives are just replicating the same kind of rhetoric and the same kind of absurdities that Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton, you know, calls WikiLeaks a Russian front. She called the third party, the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, a Russian asset. But it means that both factions of the ruling elite fail or unable, unwilling to face their responsibility for what's happened. And that's exceedingly dangerous. And now with 51 million Americans in the last poll saying that they believe the elections were rigged and that Trump actually won, you're entering very dangerous territory, accompanied, of course, by a very open attempt, and inept, fortunately, but an open attempt on the part of the Trump operatives to stage what can only be called a coup. So you've seen the rise of violence, the attempt to kidnap the governors of of Michigan and Virginia. The Proud Boys were stomping through the streets of Washington last weekend. That's with the hundreds of them, with I think four people were stabbed seriously, dozens of arrests. You had at the end of August the shooting of a Trump supporter allegedly by an Antifa supporter who was then gunned down by federal marshals unarmed outside an apartment complex in Lacey, Washington. In the same kind of state-sponsored assassinations I used to see in El Salvador. So all of it is very, very ominous. And the Republican Party is completely complicit in pushing a narrative which essentially serves to discredit the system. And I watched that happen in Yugoslavia, and I know where it goes.
Well, you actually talked about this sort of fascism about 10 years ago when you wrote in your book, American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America, which was published in, I believe, 2006. So reading that book over 10 years ago at that time when, you know, American fascism and right-wing extremism and, you know, Christian fascism in America was basically hidden in plain sight because of Obama being president. I think at that time, many people found those ideas provocative and extreme. But now in the age of Trump, Charlottesville, the Proud Boys, like you just described, and a surging far right, it almost seems prophetic what you wrote at that time. A recent poll showed that 9% of Americans, that's 23 million people, have a positive view of fascism. Presumably, you see the rise of fascism in this country as linked to the death of the liberal class and the rise in hopelessness. Can you explain that?
Well, fascism is always a product of a failed liberal class because, mm-hmm. as Noam Chomsky points out, the role of the liberal class is to ameliorate the worst excesses of capitalism, to carry out incremental and piecemeal reforms. So what happened when capitalism broke down after the 1929 crash, you saw liberalism work under the FDR administration. So massive unemployment, the government creates 12 million jobs, creates Social Security, public works projects, and as Roosevelt said, that his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. After World War II, the military-industrial complex, which did not want to dismantle the weapons systems, needed a Cold War. We forget that after World War II, because of the German invasion of the Soviet Union, Russia was devastated. Even if it had wanted to expand into Europe, it couldn't. It certainly did, and this was all carried out in the, with Stalin and Churchill and by carving up Europe, but. Russia wanted that border zone for protection. They'd been invaded twice by Napoleon and then over a century later by the Nazis. So, but the Cold War narrative was used quite effectively, not only to perpetuate what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, which is now beyond control. We don't even debate weapon right. systems. No one, it's insane, yeah. of course. And half of all discretionary spending goes into the military budget. What, you know, despite these endless feudal wars in the Middle East now pushing 20 years, all the politicians and generals who orchestrated these wars should be put on trial. It's the greatest strategic blunder in American history. And I speak as someone who spent 7 years in the Middle East. So they didn't just go after radicals. They went after the liberal class. And you had the rise of this deformed entity called the Cold War liberal. Henry Wallace and George McGovern might have been two exceptions. They were both destroyed. Wallace in 48, he had been Roosevelt's vice president, McGovern in 72. When McGovern got the nomination, you saw the Democratic Party hierarchy unite with the Republican Party hierarchy to destroy McGovern and make sure Nixon was reelected. That's, of course, what would have happened if Sanders had gotten the nomination, although the system was so fixed that I think, was an impossibility. But the destruction of the liberal class, and I wrote a book called Death of the Liberal Class that lays all this out, was myopic in that sense. that it essentially unfettered and created this unregulated corporate capitalism that has now destroyed the country. And it's supranational, has no loyalty to the nation state. It's global, massive tax boycotts. I mean, under the Eisenhower administration, the wealthiest individuals and corporations were taxed at 91%. Now, corporations like Amazon and Jeff Bezos, of course, is the richest person in the world. They paid no federal income taxes.
Zero, yeah.
In fact, they got money back from the federal government. So, but that's also true for Citibank and, you know, all sorts of other entities. So Bank of America and others. So and so essentially any way to contain even modestly unfettered capitalism, which cloaked itself in the ideology of neoliberalism. David Harvey has written his book, A Brief History of Neoliberalism, I think is probably the best explication of the economic absurdity of neoliberalism. But it was never meant to be economically rational. It always relied on these outliers like Hayek and this third-rate novelist Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman. I mean, these people are just lunatics. But it justified the accumulation of wealth by the ruling oligarchic elite. In that sense, it's worked. But it's created this kind of social inequality. So all of the recipe, the recipe for the rise of a fascist state is there. And you're right. I was, I think, sensitive to the embers of fascism within the Christian right because I come out of a religious tradition. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother was a seminary graduate, although a college professor, and I graduated from Harvard Divinity School. So I was acutely aware of how the Christian religion was being used, fusing the iconography and language of Christianity with the iconography and language of the state to create a heretical movement that essentially sacralized imperialism and capitalism. I also was well aware that this had been done in Nazi Germany. My great mentor at Harvard, James Luther Adams, had been in Germany in 1935 and 1936, and he'd been at the University of Heidelberg, including in the lecture hall where Heidegger began his lectures with the Nazi salute, and he dropped out and joined the underground so-called confessing church run by Niemöller and Albert Schweitzer and Bonhoeffer, and until he was expelled by the, he was arrested and expelled by the Gestapo. But he immediately saw in the Christian right the similarities with the German Christian church, which was outlawed in Germany after the war. And that, with the whole push to disenfranchise the working class, he realized was exceedingly dangerous to the open society, to a democratic system. He's the first person I ever heard, this was in the early 80s at Harvard, use the word fascist to describe the Christian right. And of course, he proved very prescient. I mean, even all of us students at a time, although he's brilliant, he's certainly one of the most brilliant scholars I've ever studied with, thought, you know, even he was being a little excessive. Well, it turns out that he nailed it. And so I think it's because of my tradition, because of Adams, and also because I'd spent 20 years outside the country and then came back and saw how this fringe group that, or it was a fringe group when I left the country, had moved to the epicenters of power. I was aware of how dangerous they are. So Trump, of course, has no ideological position of his own, but he's filled that void with the ideology of the Christian right. And the Christian right is closely fused with these right-wing militias. Those militia members, I think there were 18 of them that attempted to kidnap the governor in Michigan, had close ties with foundations run by Betsy DeVos. And Betsy DeVos's brother, of course, is Eric Prince, who founded Blackwater. So, you know, the perpetuation of these policies under Biden, which is what I expect, will essentially seed the ground for a competent fascist, someone like Tom Cotton, backed and supported by these forces. I think we will also, I hope I'm wrong, see an uptick of violence directed against mainstream Democrats and the media outlets that work on their behalf, like CNN, You know, we've already come close a few times. Remember that a couple of years ago, Trump supporter mailed pipe bombs to most of the hierarchy of the Democratic Party, along with CNN and other. And if they'd gone off, it would, but eventually it is going to happen. And, you know, once that death spiral of violence starts, once you open that Pandora's box, you can't control it. It controls you. I saw that in Yugoslavia. People forget the origins of the war in Yugoslavia were these posturing weekend warriors, overweight warriors in camouflage carrying AK-47s, just like we're seeing here in the United States. But once the killing starts, then it just spirals out of control. And I think nobody in Yugoslavia had any idea that they were going to engage in the worst fratricide in Europe, the worst killing in Europe since World War II.
And you know, you talk about how these attacks recently were against people within the Democratic Party and like Democratic Party aligned media like CNN. But aren't people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris aligned with the same agenda when Joe Biden's cabinet is filled with, you know, Bush era war hawks who would very much be okay with the rise of fascism in this country?
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than that. And I think that if you look back at history, and in particular Weimar, you'll see how this plays out. So the breakdown of liberal society, which took place in Weimar, especially after the 1929 crash. So you had the establishment liberals still running the country, but they were hostage now to international banks who had given them loans. So they imposed draconian forms of austerity, including, of all things, abolishing unemployment insurance. And the Nazis were considered buffoonish in the same way that the Christian right or a lot of the Trump supporters are considered buffoonish by the industrial elites. But with the breakdown of the society and the rise of powerful radical movements, in particular the Communist Party, you saw the industrial elites quite openly fund and back the Nazi Party. And that's what happened. So it's always an uncomfortable alliance. But the liberal class will always turn when threatened to those forces of fascism that end up consuming them. And again, you can look at Weimar. So you had after World War One, there was a breakdown, a series of left-wing uprisings, Spartacus Rebellion, etc. And you had the Social Democratic Party of Germany in power, led by Friedrich Ebert. And so in order to crush those uprisings, which were a threat to the liberal class, they sided with the conservatives and the nationalists and created something called the Freikorps. These were private paramilitary groups composed of demobilized soldiers and criminals and malcontents. So they ruthlessly crushed a series of uprisings in Berlin and Bremen, Brunswick, Hamburg, Leipzig, other places. And when they weren't shooting communist and left-wing populists in the streets, they were carrying out all sorts of political assassinations, over 200, including the murder of the foreign minister, as well as terrorizing civilians. So the Freikorps became the antecedents for the brown shirts, which were led by Ernst Röhm, who'd been a Freikorps commander. And so I think that you're seeing, with the breakdown of society, we're already seeing the rise of this militarized Christian fascism, and all of the elements that go to exacerbating that breakdown: political dysfunction, a discredited liberal class, mounting social inequality, an out of touch, tone deaf oligarchic elite, the fragmentation of the country into warring tribes, coupled with the increasing food insecurity and hunger, the unemployment, which has all been exacerbated by our inability to cope with the pandemic, and then the rot and stagnation of political life. This is the kind of cocktail that always leads to authoritarianism and fascism. And I expect the liberal elites, we're talking about self-identified liberals, because let's be clear, the Clinton transform the Democratic Party, in essence, into the Republican Party. The Democratic Party in Europe would be considered a far-right party, but we'll call them the self-identified right. liberals like Biden and Kamala Harris will immediately side with the most retrograde forces in the society if they feel threatened. And, you know, if history is any offers any warning, they will eventually be consumed by those very forces as well.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about authoritarianism in this country and U.S. empire. You know, you've been, you know, from Central America to the Middle East, you've seen close up the brutality of U.S. empire and what it commits around the world. Yet those tools of empire, from surveillance to militarized policing, they're increasingly being turned in on the domestic population, especially now amid this pandemic. And they have been for a while, obviously. And could you talk to me about this?
Well, first of all, we have to define what empire is. Empire is the external expression of white supremacy. It is about the theft of natural resources and the subjugation of people of color. And I just lost my closest friend, James Cone, great radical theologian, the father of Black liberation theology. And I think although James grew up in segregated Arkansas, and his life experience was different from mine. He saw the worst of white supremacy, endured it as a boy. And I saw it on the outer reaches of empire, because it's the same phenomenon, it's the same animal. And what happens is that, and this just is true in every empire, in Joseph Tainer's book, The Collapse of Complex Civilizations, where I think he looks at 24 empires, lays this out. But what happens is that all of your resources become diverted to the maintenance of empire. So at the end of the Roman Empire, you have they're running a 1 million man army, which they can't afford, and people are going hungry in the streets. So what happens is that the inability to control this military adventurism eventually starts hollowing the country out from the inside. And you can drive through just about any American city and know immediately what I'm talking about: the crumbling infrastructure, the you know, empty factories that are boarded up or derelict, the all of the attendant crises that come with that, the opioid addictions and suicides, which are highest among white middle-aged men, alcoholism, right. The gambling, sexual sadism. I don't want to let that go, because I think this recent controversy with Pornhub illustrated that we're a completely pornified society, and we're talking about torture of women. All of this moral and physical decay combined. And so you need the harsher tools of control that have been perfected on the outer reaches of empire in order to maintain domestic control. And so all of the, you know, a night raid, for instance, in Detroit by militarized police doesn't look any different from a night raid in Kandahar, because it's the same. The wholesale surveillance that now we have police department running drones, the legal mechanisms by which people are stripped of their rights if they live in marginal communities, due process, habeas corpus. 94% of the people in our prison system never had a jury trial. They're just railroaded into prison, coerced. And I don't use that word lightly. I teach in a prison. I have for 10 years. So I know this phenomenon, coerced into taking plea deals, even when they didn't commit the crime. And then they're given sentences which are 3 to 4 times longer than anywhere else in the world. All of this, the forms of social control that you use in empire, which are essentially military violence, militarized violence, wholesale surveillance, and incarceration, those are the primary forms of social control. Now that these forces have destroyed the country. And Thucydides wrote about that. He wrote the tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. And of course, that's what empires do, and that's what we're doing.
And you've also predicted a coming collapse as well. Can you discuss that?
Well, the collapse is already underway. I mean, just look around.
Right.
Half of the country lives in, I don't even know how that's debatable anymore. Half of the country lives in poverty or near poverty. We have thousands of people now lining up at food banks. The utter inability on the part of the ruling elites to deal, not first of all with the pandemic, but the economic fallout of the pandemic. And we're about to see millions of people starting after the first of the year in danger of being evicted. It's appalling. And they will push people. You know, there's no, I think, real sense among the ruling elites of how desperate, enraged, legitimately enraged people are. And that bifurcation of the country, unfortunately for us, weapons ownership has largely been criminalized for people in inner cities. But most of my family comes from Maine. Those houses are small arsenals, and they have military grade weapons. These are AR-15s. I mean, they're in essence military. That you can't use them for hunting. I used to hunt. They're useless. The caliber of the bullet is too small to take down a deer. So they're really just designed for one reason. That's to shoot people. So I think, again, that reminds me very much of Yugoslavia, where people had easy access to automatic weapons. So we're far advanced. I mean, the wars in the Middle East have been catastrophic. We've lost the war in Afghanistan. We went into Iraq. Iraq was a kind of counterweight regionally to Iran. Iraq has become, in essence, a client state, certainly allied with Iran. Not surprisingly, most Iraqis are Shia. Saddam ran a brutal Sunni minority government. So we've created one failed state after another, whether that's in Libya, Syria, or anywhere else. It's been absolutely catastrophic. I mean, aside from the fact that it's caused untold suffering to millions of people in terms of deaths and injuries, displacement, and it's perpetuated at this point only because it's profitable to a certain sector within the American economy. It makes no rational sense anymore from a strategic perspective.
And when you talk about this economic collapse and just collapse of society, considering 2020 was bad for a lot of people, but what's coming in 2021 with the evictions and just this severe loss in our society is very scary. And we talked a lot about the expansion of militarized police state and expansion of surveillance. Amid this pandemic right now, we know the state, we know that our country is using this pandemic to also encroach on our rights and, on our civil liberties. You've been writing a lot about hope as well and rebellion. Some millennial viewers will likely have first encountered you and your work during the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011. Do you think another mass movement is necessary to avoid the worst? And is it possible in this pandemic?
Well, we saw very courageous movements take to the streets of American cities, like 170 cities, after the murder of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others. So it is possible and it's necessary, but you also saw how the state responded. I think there were 117 journalists who were arrested. They were using, live rounds at some points. I mean, the suppression of those movements was quite severe. You saw a green lighting of militia movements. This happened in Kenosha with Rittenhouse, where his kid shows up with an automatic weapon, goes on a shooting spree right before the police had thanked him and other militia members for being there and giving them bottles of water. And then he walks out with his hands up and people are shouting that he just shot a bunch of people and the police let him go. And then he gets $2 million, he's out on bail, on a $2 million bail. because everybody donated. I mean, compare that to the gunning down of Reinhold, the Antifa supporter in Washington, where, you know, black SUVs pulled up at a high speed, gunmen jumped out, federal marshals jumped out and shot him. I think that those mass movements are the only mechanism we have left, but we can't be naive. We got a good glimpse of how the state will respond when it feels threatened and the alliances that they'll make when they feel threatened.
Absolutely. And do you think that we can succeed in these social movements?
That's the wrong question. I don't know. I mean, I know that if we don't try, we can't use the word hope. I think one has to be very, you know, the forces arrayed against us are powerful and strong, and the wholesale surveillance of the public dwarfs anything we've seen in human history. I covered the Stasi state in East Germany, but that's, you know, a child's play compared to what they have now in terms of just complete and utter surveillance of the entire population. And when the government watches you 24 hours a day, you can't use the word liberty. That's the relationship of a master and a slave. So I think we have to be very, we can't be self-delusional about the very dire situation we're in. We haven't even spoken about climate, the climate emergency. But if we don't resist, then there is no hope. I look at those, that kind of resistance as a moral imperative, and that of course we want to succeed, but to somehow not to resist in the face of what Immanuel Kant would call radical evil is to be complicit in that evil. And we have a responsibility not to be complicit in that evil, even if it was inevitable that we fail.
Absolutely. And if there wasn't such a strong movement for social justice and change, there wouldn't be such a tight grip by the state to control the free flow of information. There wouldn't be such a massive surveillance state and police state. You're absolutely right. And I really appreciate you, Chris Hedges, for joining us today. Chris is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who spent nearly two decades, as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Balkans, and the Middle East. He's host of On Contact on RT and author of the most recent book, America, The Farewell Tour. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Manar.